This is the Liminalist, the podcast between. This is the second live Liminalist video meetup. Choice edits from that encounter, October 1st, 2017. We're co-creating something without actually knowing what it is. That's very experimental. And, the first simile that came to my mind about experiment, maybe just because I did chemistry in school, probably most people think of a chemistry experiment. I don't know. I know I do. When I hear the word experiment, I think of chemistry, and that's appropriate with this because obviously this is about chemistry. So yeah, chemistry obviously relates to social interaction as well, and what we have here is a bunch of people coming together. I don't want to make it too tautological, is it? Or oxymoronic, I'm not sure which of them. But people coming together to find out why they're coming together, in a certain sense. And that has to do with the chemistry. Like, what happens when these individuals come together into a space? Like, what are the chemical reactions? What comes into form as a result of us coming together? I want this to work, but how does an experiment work? It works by happening, and then you find out, you find out things. So in a certain sense, it can't fail, but it can fail in the sense that it doesn't continue, like it doesn't build, we don't develop this into something that becomes less experimental and more practical. So, I think that's pretty much all I had for just like an intro. I definitely want to keep the intro short, because even though some of you did say you would prefer like a long thing, based on our first meeting and listening back, I think it is better to make it as interactive as possible. Also, a lot of you did mention that you'd like a topic. And I did really come up with a topic, at least until yesterday. And the topic I came up with possibly for today is social enlightenment. Now, this is a phrase I actually got from Dave O'Shana, so I was reluctant to use it at all, because obviously I don't want to be borrowing stuff from anyone. But the reason I thought of it was not because he's talked about it, but because I was thinking about what was the strongest theme at the last meeting, which was people's discomfort or anxiety around speaking publicly, and how I talked about dread and how those two things intersected. Anyway, I won't go into too much, just that that's a possible theme for today. You know, what is social enlightenment, and how these meetings can help us to attain that. Social liberation, actually, you might have even used that term. It has to do with, or at least how I experience it, has to do with an ability to be comfortable and relaxed in oneself in any kind of social situation.
Does that include a fight or a conflict? Or?
Interesting. That's an interesting question, because some people can actually feel more relaxed and more comfortable in a conflict situation.
Mm-hmm.
So, although that seemed like an obvious question or a logical question, it isn't necessary for some people. Like, for me, I find it harder to be socially at ease in a very ordinary social situation. That's the most difficult for me.
I mean, I suppose if you think of, like, the martial arts ideal of being trained and that you're then comfortable within yourself, but that doesn't seem to include losing. Though, and losing seems to be, or being dominated, or those sorts of things, failing. I don't understand how you can be comfortable with that. I mean, that's really my issue with these theories of enlightenment and philosophies of enlightenment and so on, is that they don't seem to me to have a reasonable method for dealing with conflict, the reality of conflict that, that everybody has to deal with throughout their lives. And it seems that part of neurosis, part of egotism and so on, it relates to having to fight, and therefore it's a kind of defensive measure that's ultimately not totally resolvable, something that you always have to, you have to retain some kind of structure, personality structure, to deal with those kinds of threats. So that, yeah, that's why I think conflict perhaps is different, a different kind of issue.
Okay, all right. You said an awful lot there. I mean, a lot of different things, points all mashed together. But so let's just bring it back to the original point, which is social liberation and my definition of it, which is being at ease in any kind of situation. Okay, so for me, and you talked about winning and losing, which I'd say is an ego concern. I mean, it could be survival-based, but in most social interactions, the question of whether we win or lose isn't related to survival. It's related to self-image, how, you know, how we perceive ourselves and how we perceive others are perceiving us, which is a very interesting question in and of itself, because we don't know how others perceive us unless we check with them. But we're constantly having this sense that we do know how we're being perceived. So we're constantly imagining how others are seeing us and seeing ourselves through that imagined idea. And all of that is, I would say, superfluous. Like, that can be jettisoned, that whole idea about the other and how they might perceive us. And the tendency to see and judge our, and analyze our own behavior through the imagined perception of another, all of that, I think, can be relinquished. Now, whether that would be total enlightenment or whether that would be social liberation, or, you know, I can't speak about enlightenment. That's why I didn't speak about it. I mean, that's why I don't speak about it, unless I'm talking about, you know, as a concept. But the social liberation, I feel that I can talk about to some extent. I wouldn't say that I'm completely there, but
I just had a couple thoughts that came up. One while Martin and you were talking about the conflict thing, I was realizing that, well, it's kind of along the lines of what you were saying, that most of it is usually in my head. And there's some connection between being comfortable, and for me, being comfortable and being in action, because most of the discomfort comes from like a feeling of dread or thinking about something beforehand. Like, I have this idea that I'm horrible in social situations, and I try, but a lot of the time everything goes fine, and I find I'm able to be in the moment, and I'll be in a conversation with somebody, and everything goes good. And then, you know, but it's thinking about it before and thinking about it after. But when the thing's actually happening, it's fine. So I don't know. One thing I noticed a lot, and this is through work, because at my job, I'm like in a position where I'm, I have a purpose. And I've heard you talk about this before a lot, and I relate to it when you talk about being at the thrift store and kind of like sometimes dreading the interactions with people. But then, kind of seeing everybody as just like a different, like kind of everyone's traumatized to some degree or another, and to be able to identify that in people. I get this a lot because I have prolonged interactions with people at work. And I find that a lot of times they're pretty hesitant when they first come in, almost fearful. So it's easy for me to recognize that and try and maybe put them at ease a little bit, which gets me out of myself. But it can also work the other way, where I totally react to their fear, and it sets off something in me. And you know, so it's just something that I've noticed, and I get to practice it a lot, and you know, try and just I don't know, be present with it, or maybe be helpful or something like that. That's kind of like the only solution I found. I can't like think my way out of it, or I can't, you know, I don't know. Those are just a couple thoughts that came up. So I want to try and get it out before I forgot.
I've never heard of the term social enlightenment before. Is it a new modern term, or where does it come from? You said, in what context?
Well, as I said, I might have actually misquoted. It might have been social liberation that Dave talked. I think he used both. So that's where it came from. And it was on one or two retreats a few years back, and the context that he presented it in was as a necessary precursor to genuine enlightenment, is social liberation or social enlightenment. And I think he talked about how he had confronted all the areas in himself and in his life that he was not comfortable, that he was afraid, that he had anxiety, that he had self-consciousness and inhibition, and just sort of pushed into those areas. And it's something I've done all my life. And of course, doing this today is that. I mean, I never stopped doing it, moving outside of my comfort zone socially. You know, and when we talk about social interaction, I do want to talk about this as well, because I think that has to do with the point I didn't finish. You know, that all of my areas of dread have to do with human interaction. Martin has something to say, and the feeling that it can go wrong. And so social liberation would have to do with basically becoming free of that concern, being able to interact with other human beings without any concern or dread that one was going to get it wrong. Like, social liberation has to do with becoming more conscious of our patterns and of our neuroses and our inhibitions and of our reactions to social situations. I've become a lot less of an angry person in the last couple of years. I mean, last 10, 20 years, it's been an ongoing thing, but noticeably in the last couple of years. But I've become a lot more conscious of my anger. So, and that seems like a contradiction, but it isn't. Because now I observe the anger that's actually moving inside of me, and I think, oh, God, I'm angry again. What's wrong with me? I'm so neurotic. Why am I getting angry over nothing? In the past, I would simply react with anger and think, this is a fucked up situation, and I'm going to fix it with my anger because I'm right. So I wasn't even aware of the anger, really. I just thought it was me being right. So there's a correlation there. The more conscious we become and the more fluid and responsive and responsible, the more aware we can become of our neurotic patterns.
Do you think that Dave O'Shana, either he's totally aware of the effect he has on other people, or he's totally indifferent to it? In retaining that social peace or social enlightenment, or in that, is which one is it, or is it a bit of both? That either it doesn't matter to him, or he is totally aware of the effect that he has and is reconciled with it.
You know, I don't think it's either. That's an interesting question, because I've definitely seen in Dave that he's not conscious of stuff. He's definitely not 100% conscious. So whatever he's calling enlightenment, it's not that. It's not being 100% conscious in the sense of, you know, not having an unconscious. So then it's neither. I mean, I'll just give you a short answer. I don't think it's either of those things. Because what I'm discovering as I get closer to social liberation, if not enlightenment, isn't that, I mean, yes, I'm becoming more aware of how I'm acting, certainly. So I am becoming more conscious, but I'm still aware that there's unconscious stuff moving. I'm definitely not becoming more indifferent to how it affects people. That's becoming more acute. The responsibility, as with Tuco, you know, the consequences of my actions, hopefully not as a fear-based thing, because I do have fear around that, around death and stuff, but just as becoming more sensitized, you know, more empathic. So I'm definitely not becoming more indifferent, what I am becoming more indifferent to is how it reflects upon me. Like if I act poorly, I definitely want to be aware of the consequences on that person or that situation so I can address it. And I touched on this last meeting, but what I don't want or need to do is use that as a way to beat myself up or measure my own worth, because that just adds noise to it. So to me, it's becoming more and more reduced, pared down to, was I following the energy there or was I not? And if I'm following the energy and I'm in the flow of the energy, then I don't have to be aware of everything, because A, I can't, B, the energy's going to go that way anyway, and C, I'm going to find out the stuff I'm acting unconsciously on, it is going to come back and, you know, not necessarily blow up in my face, hopefully not, but just it will somehow reflect back in people's reactions to what I'm doing. And that's where I think that actually is the beauty of a social interaction, and how, you know, what occurred to me when we're talking about the social liberation, it sounds like, you know, when we talk about social interaction, it's as if we're just talking about one thing among many, but really, what else is there? I mean, Mari talked about last week, you know, how she had trouble with this idea that we have to grow through the other. But what else is there? I mean, yeah, I like my solo time, but essentially, even my solo time is still in the context of the collective. Like, I'm never not aware of others out there, and I'm never not connected to others. So, it's funny that we single out social interaction, at least I do, as if it was one aspect of our experience. But as human beings, social animals, really we're just talking about life when we talk about social interaction. Especially if you include cats and birds and stuff, which I suppose you wouldn't necessarily, but I don't know why not. So I feel like I didn't quite finish the point about the energy. So if I'm in the flow of the energy, responding to a person, then I don't have, and so bring it back to Dave, I think that he doesn't, in a certain sense, yeah, he's indifferent to other people's response or, you know, the effect, in a certain sense, and to his own lack of awareness, because I think that he's spontaneously responding to a combination, this is difficult to put into words, but to the interface between the social environment and the energy of the body. Like, there's a constant meeting between the energy of the body, the life force, and the environment that it's in. Like, the life force is constantly moving to meet the environment, and the environment is constantly stimulating the life force. And there's that point of contact which is always happening, and it's always different. And so I think to the extent that Dave's attention is exclusively on that instant of interface, then he puts his complete trust in that the life force always knows how to respond to the environment, and the environment will always act in certain ways to correct the life force. And if correct is quite the right word there, but guide it. So, you know, when I'm talking now, that's happening now because I'm also looking at the faces that I can. Some of them are actually frozen because it's Mari's just got an image. Nick doesn't move much, so sometimes I think his image is just a frozen thing. Same with Martin, and sometimes Martin is actually frozen. Francis is the most expressive, and Mike, well, he's shrunken down there, but he's got the physical stuff going on, but there isn't so much there. But anyway, my point is that's the thing that I'm using as a part of the environment. I mean, it's a computer screen, right? I've actually got the whole world around me, but right now what's on my computer screen is more relevant in terms of environmental adjustments of my life force, in a certain sense, or as relevant as what's going on in my whole greater environment, because I'm speaking to you all. So, I mean, that just sounds, in a way, it's really obvious. When you have a conversation, you check somebody's face, and you try and gain not just their face, actually not face-centrics, but we are a bit, but we're actually tuning into the whole body to gauge, are we communicating? Are we making a good impression, is what the ego's asking. But the more that program is running, the more we're checking the other or the environment to see, to kind of measure our own self-worth, the less we're able to actually just read it and respond to it. So I think that's the social liberation, the freedom of concern about what others think of us. Freedom, total freedom from concern about what others think of us. That's social liberation. And yet, that doesn't mean, that doesn't mean that we don't care about others, of course. Like, we separate what others think from their being. Unmute.
Hello, hello. I think that's a really good point that you're making, and it sounds good, but how do you get to that point? How do you get to that point where you're able to be authentic and spontaneous in your actions and not self-conscious and reacting? So I don't know.
But you have observed changes in yourself around that. Like, there must be times in your life when you've been more self-conscious, more inhibited, and less. And even, would you say that you are less restricted or socially inhibited now than you were 10 years ago?
I think I feel a bit similar to you in the idea that I'm more aware of myself. And I don't know if it does tie in with our conversation, but I'm actually rereading Dale Carnegie's book, How to Win Friends and Influence People. And it's really interesting because it's actually reminded me of that idea of social lubrication and politeness. It's in a way to, I don't want to say get what you want, but I definitely feel like in this culture at the moment, we are very forceful. You know, we disagree with people quite violently. And this book's really reminded me that there's a way to communicate, that you can disagree without, you know, kind of alienating the other person. But I don't know if I'm able to put it into effect just yet.
Okay, well, it's a bit roundabout, but it sounded like you were acknowledging that you're more comfortable with yourself and with people now than before. Wouldn't you say that? Or would you say that?
Yeah, definitely. But not in terms of conflict.
Oh, so that's bringing back to Martin's point. So when you're in conflict, then you lose your equilibrium.
Yeah, exactly. I think that's the time it, I feel like it challenges us the most, when we disagree with somebody or they disagree with us.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Well, but just to stay with the first thing, which is why I asked you that, because you were saying that you don't know how and to become more liberated, but apparently you do, because you've been moving slowly towards that anyway. So I mean, and that would, I mean, that's the only reason I'm able to talk about it, is because of having had the experience of it, but not to the extent that I can give a formula for it. I mean, I might end up trying, but certainly, and I do wonder if Dave's an Aries, because in a lot of ways he seems like one. I did address my own, I have addressed my own social anxiety, as I said, in similar ways that he has. He even did stand-up comedy. I never crossed that horrific line, but I've done pretty much everything else in terms of putting myself out there into situations that will challenge me. I mean, stage fright is a big thing. That's like a sort of magnified version of what we're talking about, social anxiety, right? It's being seen. You know, the fear of being seen, being exposed. And of course, if we're on stage and we've got a bunch of people in front of us who are expecting us to give them something that they came to get, and we don't necessarily know if we can, but we've basically committed to doing so, then it's possible that we'll get paralyzed. And that, you know, the alternative to paralysis is fight or flight, kind of, we overcompensate. We'll go into an exaggerated way of being to, and this is what I, you know, I'm constantly sort of checking on these meetings, is because it can be very subtle, it doesn't have to be obvious, that to what extent will I fall back on a persona that is outmoded in order to escape the anxiety of actually being liminal. I feel like we could talk about identity now, really, because it's what we're getting down to. And so now enlightenment as a concept, and Martin addressed this, is freedom from identity. Well, that's one way you could define it anyway, that's one way it has been defined. Whereas social liberation seems to be more to do with being absolutely comfortable with one's persona. But I think that the two are related. And for me at least, like the process of becoming less socially anxious, less inhibited, more free in my social interactions and more spontaneous and therefore more authentic, it definitely hinges upon the letting go of fixed ideas about who I am. Like starting with opinions, like Francis was talking about conflict, disagreement, that's something I'm very aware of around movies particularly. So something came out here now, somebody can interject, this might be a ramble, but no, I'm not sure if I should mention it, feels like it'd be a digression. Okay, so yeah, I won't. So identity, really, it's you know, to what extent does an identity exist outside of a response to the other? Because as babies, it doesn't. If babies were just, well, I don't remember this, but I've read about it, smiling back at the smiling mother, or you know, we're reflecting, developing a sense of ourselves through the other that is communicating with us. So we develop a sense of identity through relationship with the other, and then it gets fixed. We all know all of this, right? So getting back to that, not infant state, but at least the awareness that our sense of identity and our expression is always going to be a response to the other. It can't be anything else. Or, well, it can be, because it can just be, you know, an imposition of our own sense of who we are on the other, on the situation. And that's always going to be uncomfortable for everyone. Except people will go along with it. Now, as you all know, I'm in the thrift store. The hardest thing for me is going along with people coming in with their identities fixed and then imposing them on me. And I'm supposed to then, like two rams, bang our identities together. And that's social etiquette. Like that kind of thing is just never ending if we care what people think. As in, you know, that part, the social program, if we care what that's. And I can't turn mine off, but I can just notice that there's a part of me that isn't identified with the program. So that, oh, now I'm worrying about what that person thinks. Then I'm the awareness that's noticing that I'm worrying, or etc., as opposed to actually being the worrying. I mean, we all here have that, we're aware that there's at least two of us in here, in there, wherever, you know. Like we can be in patterns and at the same time know that we're in patterns and think, oh fuck, I'm in a pattern again. I'm having these same responses and these same stupid thoughts. Like I imagine everyone here to some degree has that experience, and that in itself is an opening, because we see, okay, I can move into the worry, into the social anxiety of identifying with what's expected of me, or I can move more into the part that's noticing that and saying, is that true? Unfortunately, it's a cliche, but the main thing really is staying in the moment, so that it really doesn't matter how unpleasant any given moment is, or how many there are, because there's always another moment. It's like we get a constant opportunity to reset. Martin said he gained an insight. Did you want to share it, Martin?
Yes, yeah, I'd like to share it, yeah. What came to mind when you were talking about it being neither a question of worrying about what other people think or being indifferent to it, what came to mind was like a net, and that the net, you're a point in the net, or like, say, on the surface of the sea, and the net is on the surface of the sea, and your sense of social enlightenment is like a damping of all of the tumult that's being communicated to you by the sea and by the other pieces of the net, which are the other people around you, and that enlightenment is a complete awareness of your connection, but at the same time that you absorb the turbulence, and that it comes into you, and you act as a kind of a damping, kind of calming part of the whole structure. So that was the image that came to my mind when you were talking about that. Now, a part of what he seems to have achieved is, and where Francis was talking about how do you get to this point, it seems to me something that it's a result of a lot of training. It's a training of the mind. It's a skill. It's a technique of maintaining that boundary, of being on that boundary of mediation between sort of aggression or emotion or fear and those sorts of things, that you're mediating it into, as you say, mediating it into the earth or mediating it into the universe through your own body. So you're mediating distress via the mind into the fabric of yourself and the wider fabric of the world. So the mind becomes that. It's a training to make the mind into that mediating point instead of it being confused and turned in on itself.
Called the girl Jenny, she said that tonight. I know her better as Jenny the Game. Threw out her letters from the ring I bought. This old border town's as far as I got. It's colder than death. Get down to 13 hearts.
because we have this term for the mind that we use very easily and frequently, and there's this assumption that we know what we're talking about and we're all talking about the same thing, but that might just be an assumption. Like, what is the mind as different or as distinct from the body?
I do see them as separate, because I've heard it called the mind-body mechanism, and I like that because I like the distinction. I like when we discuss mind to be talking specifically about the contents of your sort of head, that which goes on above the neck, the computations, the words, the language specifically is very mind-oriented, but also images, memories. Also, I think sometimes the ego comes into it as well. I mean, it's very fine to define. The body has its own sort of, you know, it's in space and time, whereas the mind isn't. You know, there is these distinct qualities. And I think the more refined we can get in our distinctions and the more we can agree upon them, I think the better we can understand what we're talking about, obviously. But, yeah, the mind for me is the workings of my head, the computations, the thoughts, the analysis, all of that, whereas the body is this sort of lump of flesh and meat which has its own signals and sensors, and they're qualitatively different. I didn't get any of that because it was...
I just said unless that the mind as you defined it is a function of the body. I just wanted to put that in as a qualifier because...
Right, yeah, definitely. I think that you can't say the mind and body are separate in any way like that. It is a function of the body, and yet because we're so mind oriented, to just describe the body as mind confuses my mind. You know, in my mind there's a definite difference.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Categories, right? Okay. Who's next? Nick.
I feel like, to me, the mind is very language oriented, and it's, for me, it's kind of like the stream of culture and language that is trying to make sense of the psyche, or kind of like giving a representation of what's going on with the psyche. And whereas the psyche can be more in like flowing, the mind is reading off a stream of language. And I feel sometimes that I can tell a difference between thinking in language, but then also having some kind of understanding through images. I don't know if that's... It's, for me, the images seem more in the flow, but language seems more disconnected and more as like an observer rather than like being like feeling connected to the body and like the... in the moment, sort of, that feel.
Francis, what do you think? Unmute, please.
Yeah, that's a question. What I'm striving towards embodiment, and I think there is a distinction between the mind and body. I don't know if there should be. I don't know. But at the same time, the idea that, as Nick was talking about, the physical reactions that he's experiencing in regards to his brother, which may be neurological imprints from an earlier experience, you know, that have laid themselves down, those neurological pathways, which... they may be experienced in his mind, but they come from his body, his brain. So I don't know. I don't know, actually. That's my answer.
Yeah, well, I think we probably can all agree that we don't know. and yet we have opinions and beliefs, and we often talk as if we do know, and we do use the word mind. In either case, we're looking at the mind as an aspect of the body that has a specific configuration, and that configuration is both influenced by content and also influences the content in some way, or reshapes it, or recontextualizes it. So when we're talking about training the mind, I think we're talking about actually restructuring the mind in some way. Almost like I'm getting the image now, very easy to come to me because I'm surrounded by it, of when I renovated this house. You know, basically had to attack the structure at very basic levels in order to restore it to a healthy, into a healthy habitation. Because it was a crack house, as you, probably most of you know. There was an enormous amount of cleaning that went on, but then there was also deconstruction, you know, tearing down, and not that I'm recommending this as an extended thing, but yeah, maybe it is. Anyway, obviously it's not literal, but emptying out, really, was what it came down to. But an emptying out that involved actually taking down some of the structures, but not so many that the whole thing collapsed. And it was on the edge of that, you know, the hardest part of renovating this house, the hardest parts were when I got to walls that I didn't know if I could take down, the whole ceiling might collapse. And then when I got to walls that were bare, they were like floating walls, like, what, there's nothing holding this wall up, but we can't get rid of it because it's the front. You know, it's the front of the house. So then I had to figure out ways and make it maybe sound like I was more skilled at this than I am, because a lot of it was just, you know, really just making it up so it went along. But anyway, I had to figure out ways to reinforce the structures that were necessary and get rid of the ones that weren't. Mostly about creating more space. To the extent, in fact, that I realized recently that my house, actually, it's not that comfortable. I mean, I don't actually find it very cozy, was what I said to my wife. There's actually nowhere in this house I feel that comfortable, really. Because I really like sort of cozy rooms. You feel, or some part of me does. And we've done the house in such a way that it's all open spaces, and there's really nowhere, like everywhere, every room is on its way to some other room, and so there's nowhere you can just sort of hide away. Even my attic has this. Anyway, I won't go into all the details. Obviously, I'm only showing this because it's metaphorical, that we probably want a mind, I know I do, that is spacious, that lets free communication through all the different parts and the fresh air and all of that. You know, just but that is structured, that is a sturdy structure. So it's not about getting rid of it, clearly. Any more than we'd get rid of a house. But we don't necessarily want to spend the whole time in the house. I mean, I don't know if the analogy might fall down at a certain point, because, anyway, I think it already has fallen down, not the house. So my view for a while has been that mind is like digestion, or thinking is like digestion, something that the body does or can do or needs to do. But you can have a digestive system that is overstimulated, is constantly working, and so you're always burbling away and farting and belching, and it's not comfortable. You know, clearly something's out of whack, probably from stuff you've eaten. So I'd say that similar with the mind, like if we fill the mind with too much junk, culture, then it gets overstimulated and it's overworking, and so it's just constantly burbling and bubbling away, consuming enormous amounts of energy of the body just to make, you know, gases and weird sounds, but not really doing anything that's useful. So I guess that training the mind a big part of training the mind, as I said, it's reconfiguring. It has to do with what we put into it, or what we take out of it. This is an interesting question, because can you actually remove parts of the mind? That's MK Ultra. I don't have an answer to that. I think that there is a kind of self-surgery that I've been engaged with for many years, which has attracted many of you. And again, Seen and Not Seen is the best example. I'll call it Yorkshire also, which came out, which Seen and Not Seen led into. But Seen and Not Seen shows the machinery of it more clearly, or the process of performing surgery on one's own mind. Jed McKenna calls it spiritual autolysis. Yes, Mari.
For me, I was thinking, it's bloody gone now. It's just a simple point about training the mind. I don't think you can. I mean, I always have this problem, you know, think positive thoughts. Well, in the instant that I need to, I'll never remember that. I'll be swept up in the ego's churning or the mind's churning. But so without really calling it meditation, although that's the word I want to use, it's more, for me, the process that I'm in the moment is becoming more aware of the thinking going on, because then I can choose whether or not to engage with it and see plainly that's just some pattern, some bullshit, some ego or some black coming from, and I can specifically see what it's about rather than being trapped in that thought and having to see it and being that thought, you know. So you're saying about if the mind is thought, I don't think it is. I think that's just something that you say that it does. Because I'm trying to think of, like, you know, Julian Joyce's The Bicameral Mind, when we didn't think, perhaps, as a theory anyway, that it was more like animals do. But there had to be the animals are going over there, we need one person over there, one person over there, and we'll ambush them here. Some sort of computational thing going on, but less social bullshit to deal with.
Yeah. Okay, so I understand that the mind did exist in some form as a part of the body, a function of the body, before we developed thinking, as in language, at least, if we're equating thinking with language, which not everyone would necessarily agree with that. So that's a fair point. The other thing that came to me while you're talking is that, I mean, as I said, thought itself is energy. So the mind is energy, body's energy, everything's energy, so it doesn't necessarily mean anything at a certain point. But what I've observed with the mind, I think you were referring to there indirectly, is that when we give attention to our thoughts, we give them energy. And I think thoughts actually become semi-autonomous. I guess talk about thought forms. It's like they become very difficult to put this into words. My mind doesn't want me to, or the implant doesn't want me to, something doesn't want me to. But I mean, you could also, Francis was talking about neuronal pathways, you could also look at it that way, like when we have impacting traumatic experiences, then it creates deep grooves in the neurons, and so then in the pathways in the brain, and so then the neurons just naturally get pulled into those grooves, and so we end up feeling the same feelings again and again, like getting re-triggered. But also, this is a subtle level with thoughts. Like, the more often, frequently we think a thought, the more we create a pathway, whether it's in the brain or the body or the energy or all of the, for that thought. And so then that pathway in the end ends up generating the thought itself. So it's like a self-generating patterns of thought. And so they have enough energy then to become somewhat autonomous, so then they will just pop up into our awareness out of nowhere, and we'll be having the same thoughts we had before. And then the extent to which we give attention to those thoughts and have an emotional response to them, believe them. For me, it's 3 o'clock in the morning, my life's shit, I gotta get the fuck out of here, maybe I'll even kill myself because things are so bad. Thoughts that really are just, what the fuck, you know, this is not me here, but they're so compelling. I mean, they're so sort of forceful or insistent that I do have an emotional response to them. I start thinking, oh my God, my life is shit. Oh my God, maybe I do want to be dead or whatever else it is. Maybe I'm going to flee. And then I'm energizing the thoughts further. So they're like little mind parasites. They know how to trigger us so that we will feed them. And that would be the training, would be isolating, quarantine, putting those little thought clusters on mind virae into quarantine so that they aren't getting access to our life force. Yes, Jeff.
I just was having some thoughts that I wanted to try and get out. Going back to when Nick was talking about language and just where this whole thing is going. I was thinking about how my body reacts to either a fear of or an actual inability to express myself, and how I feel that, you know, build up. And it made me think about how it's symbols are like, it's like the mind turns into the brain as the brain wants to translate symbols into language. Like when you were talking about like the house and everything like that, your house. And I was thinking about how, what a symbol that is and how like everything, in the physical world could be looked at as a symbol. But then when I need to, define it so specifically, it creates a tension in me. So like you were talking about how to undo that. I just was having this, you know, idea of like going backwards and turning the language back towards symbols. So everything kind of works more on multiple levels. Like I feel like the language is just a mind thing. Whereas the symbols, you know, work on like many different levels and speak to the subconscious more. So if I'm having that tension in my body and my mind and feeling kind of stuck, I can almost turn that back towards, well, this is a symbol of something. And then it kind of frees me up to not have to be so specific about the language. I don't know if that made any sense at all, or if that's, in the vein of what we're talking about.
I think that does approach something fundamental about the mind, which is insofar as it's using language to represent reality to us, it's misrepresenting reality. So, well, I don't know if there's anything more to add to that. I mean, what you're describing is not, maybe not reverse engineering is not the term, but getting back, moving back towards the source of consciousness. I touched on this in my conversation with my sister recently on the podcast, was, okay, what comes before language in terms of mind awareness is images, and then what's before that? Sensation. What's before sensation even? Like, we could also see this in terms of our experience as individuals. We began as consciousness, as far as we know, could have been something prior to the womb. It's going to be graphic there. Now I can't get my father's testicles out of my mind. Anyway, we were consciousness in the womb, obviously before we had a name or an identity. So what was that? You know, what were the contents of our consciousness then? What were the contents of our mind when we were in the womb? You could say we didn't have a mind, or you could say, if it was Mari saying that mind is an instinctive function of an organism, I shouldn't say that, but anyway, I'm paraphrasing, then even as fetuses we would have had some rudimentary kind of mind. So then what were the contents of the mind? Well, presumably, well, a certain point, I mean, there wouldn't have even been sound or sensation. but anyway, at a certain point, sound, sensation, temperature, and then, but no images. So it's not as though we've been divorced from that experience. Like, we remember what happened yesterday, and we feel it still impacts us, if it was, you know, whatever, if it triggered us, or if it haunts us. Proximity makes it seem real, but obviously formative experiences are more fundamental, and just because they're further away and harder to access by the mind, because it can't retrieve those files, they're still present. So every night when we dream, we go into dreamless sleep for several hours. It doesn't feel like I do, I have to say. I feel like I dream all night long, and I just can't stop it. But I presume that there's areas there that I just don't notice because I'm not, whatever, you know, the kind of consciousness is so unfamiliar, I've got no symbols for it. Anyway, point simply being that we're that fetal state of awareness, of a mind that is pre-symbolic awareness even, is with us, even in the present.
With Jeff's point about symbols and language, it just reminds me of the role that symbols play in occultism and demonology and so on. And I think that's probably why symbols and sigils are so important within that methodology, is because they are able to capture parts of a person in a way that language can't. I'm still struggling to understand what a demon is, or what that worldview is about. But I find it very interesting and telling that demons are represented by symbols. And it seems to me that a demon, in a way, is a captured part of oneself, and it's captured by the symbol. The symbol is the representation of that capturing, and the reminder of the capturing of that part of yourself. And I think that's why those things are invoked within occultism by the representations of those symbols. So that was the point I wanted to make.
I was thinking about language and movies, and how, like, when we have the protagonist in a movie and, like, putting some kind of emotional tag on different characters in a film, and how those may channel violence, like to change the language that runs in our mind to kind of like form a groove towards violence, like having some kind of a positive emotional response to a character in a film, and then having that become kind of like an unconscious groove towards having a similar thought pattern that that character has in that film. And then I was thinking of how, when you've talked about mimetic rivalry and like René Girard's theory, and I lost my train of thought, but the becoming conscious of scapegoating the other, like where we're directing our violence through our thoughts, through our language, like how does the language channel our violent feelings from trauma, rather than looking at the root of the trauma in our life. The language is presented to us through media to channel that violence towards a specific direction that is attached to some kind of emotional response to the characters in the media.
Thanks, Nick. It's another interesting line of inquiry. In terms of that last point, I did have a thought to bring it back to social liberation, because of course we talk about mimetic rivalry, stresses Francis' point about conflict, and you talk about violence and patterns of identification which are reinforced through violence or reinforced violent behaviours, negative identity, all of that. Well, because that's the society that we want to be liberated from. It's a society that we live in. And it just occurred to me that social liberation could, I mean, I've been talking about it in terms of being free within society. But then there's also the notion of being free from society, which is perhaps the stage beyond social liberation. I mean, perhaps that does pertain to enlightenment in terms of no longer being beholden to the social patterns of mimesis. I think it's interesting because I brought up the point about how there's no identity without the other, and then enlightenment being freedom from identity. Well, I think if our orientation was entirely inward, then our behavior would be determined by an internal response, which is what I talked about a couple of weeks ago. I thought I would talk more about it today, but I didn't. But anyway, to the extent that we become alive to that and our awareness is directed towards that internal life force, then we relinquish forms of mimesis. We become less and less dependent on mimesis to know how to behave socially. And so then we develop more and more a sense of identity that doesn't depend on the other. It would be a no identity identity, essentially. I'm wary of talking about that because it gets into areas that I can't corroborate. Yeah, okay, well, so I don't necessarily have anything else. My ears have popped, so I'm grabbing my nose like that just in the last couple of minutes. My ears, like the pressure has changed, like we're going down.
It's been really interesting, this chat. I've really enjoyed it tonight. I've really got a lot from it. Insights bubbling that I wouldn't really be able to vocalise, but like, oh, mimetic, that's, I had a vision of, that's when I do that. Like, this thing that I do that really annoys me is when I'm in conversation with somebody, I'll pick up their affectations. So it's so obvious, particularly when the person's got a lisp or something like that, and it kills me every time. And it, just today, I could forgive that when you said, "Oh, that's this mimeticist is what you, is that what you called it? Mimesis, yeah." And being able to put a symbol to that behaviour kind of helps me to forgive it. And another thing that came up I wanted to ask was, do you think this mimesis is natural, like the mind of the human being? It's a function of people coming together, or was it something designed by, you know, our friends in the CIA, MK Ultra, you know, discovered and played upon so that they could use these levers to control society? Sorry, to end on the question. I just really, all I wanted to say was it's been really great tonight. I've got a lot from it.
Mimesis is so basic. Like, that's what I was saying about the baby with the mother. Like, the baby learns to have a sense of itself through responding to the mother's expression and imitating it. So mimesis is really the basis of socialization for human beings, but it's also in the animal kingdom. I mean, animals learn behaviors through imitation. I mean, a lot of it's hardwired and instinctive, but even with animals there's an element of mimesis, as far as I know. That doesn't mean it can't, those principles can't be applied by our unmentionable friends, which of course they are. But so that's the sort of awareness that, and maybe this is the upside of, what are the upsides of studying all this stuff, is becoming aware of the science of consciousness control and all of that. To some extent, we can re-engineer ourselves, to some extent. But I think the main element is what Murray just said, is self-compassion and forgiving those behaviors in ourselves that we find unappealing. Like recognizing them is the first step, and then forgiving them is the next, I think, as opposed to trying to fix them. What's that Jesus said about, it's not the outside of the cup that matters, it's the inside. Recorded this, I'll send you the audio, and any feedback is welcome. And as I said, we're still in the experimental phase, so you're all the early adopters, so that means that you get special privileges, we're, you know, more liminal, at the most liminal phase ever. Keep on showing up, and we'll find our way to whatever it is that this is becoming. Maybe it'll just be us, or maybe there'll be more. I was surprised by it. Nobody responded. I thought I had a bigger fan base than that. Like, as far as I know, I got like 2,000 listeners or something. So they're obviously very, very passive. I mean, really, like, if I was listening to some guy I was really interested in, and he's just like, hey, come join a video meetup, I'd be right there. Yeah, but I don't know. I don't have that kind of listener, obviously. They're hiders, lurkers.
People are afraid of you, Jason.
I don't think so. Not really a very scary guy. I just think it's an interesting thing that I have a seemingly large audience, but a very tiny percentage that actually is in for, you know, direct interaction. That's the end of this podcast. The live video liminalist meetup events will continue as long as there's interest, once every 2 weeks. So that means the next scheduled meetup is for October the 15th, 2017. It's a very small group at present. I'm in the process of setting up a forum space where we can discuss what we're discussing and continue to work out the nature of the enterprise, what it is we're doing and what we want to get from it, and how it can best develop in the most effective way. It's looking to me, after just the second meeting, that it's shaping into more of an ongoing workshop focusing on social liberation, deconditioning, social re-engineering of the psyche, all of the things that my life's been dedicated towards, with reference to the big picture as well, like how I've used that as a sort of large surgical mirror and map, as without, so within, the way to locate and isolate the implants, the cultural implants in myself, and dissolve them through the healing and corrosive balm of attention and awareness, such as it's been proceeding, and many of you have been following this with interest. If any of you are bold enough to want to step through the looking glass and start actually trying to apply some of the knowledge that you may have gained by following what I'm doing, this would be the opportunity. This workshop space is an intense space, and so it's not for everyone. I mean, it goes without saying, it's putting it mildly. At present, the group's very small, it's just five or six of us, so there's room for a few more, perhaps not many more. I want to keep the group small, at least in the early stages. The next meetup, I think I'll probably go around the group to find out what drew you to my work, what it is that you get from it, what it is that you would hope to get from regular meetings, so that together we can work out the best form, structure, purpose, methodology, and so on and so forth. It's an interactive collaboration that I'm hosting and facilitating. My main job is to create the space and to facilitate the discovery of our natures within that space, roughly summed up there. So if you are interested, just send me an email. If you haven't filled out the horticulture form, just go to the website in the community section, the top right hand corner, there's a scroll down thing and it's horticulture questionnaire. That's the best way to introduce yourself to me and give me a little bit of personal information. If you haven't done this already, if you have, just email me. Also, if you've been on the podcast already, then that's a good start. Okay, I think that's everything. Thanks once again for listening and supporting. I'm not sure if there's been any donations. Let me look. Let me thank Kelvin. No, there haven't really been donations to speak of. Kelvin. Kevin. He said he's going to up his to 20. So thanks in advance for that. Okay. This is it. Over and out.